In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We continue the exploration into the spiritual warfare now being associated with certain mental illness, specifically schizophrenia. Once thought to be auditory hallucinations, many mental health therapists consider this rediscovery a breakthrough in learning the origins of the voices plaguing victims with this disorder. For many schizophrenics, the voices are known to be vulgar, grotesque, and anti-human, ultimately driving the tormented state of a now fragmented mind. The pharmaceutical companies and universities emphasize the voices aren't external, and they belong to the patient. However, past guest Jerry Marzinski says from his 30 years of experience as a mental health therapist, he's convinced the voices are external to the patient. In fact, the voices are actually some type of predator. Call it a demon, etheric parasite, negative entity. These things have a complex strategy, a system to feed off of human suffering. The attacks can begin with benign, chronic negative thoughts. The unnatural negative thought pattern can feed depression, anxiety, anger, despair, and envy, which may lead to a downward emotional spiral. This can create the charged energy of a negative emotional state. There are many catalysts, Jerry says, including drug use and Ouija boards. The revelation that spiritual warfare can be attributed to certain psychotic conditions isn't necessarily a new concept. However, the renewed understanding that the voices are very likely malevolent spiritual manifestations has begun to change the path and approach to treatment for schizophrenia. We take a deeper look at the strategies and patterns of these entities with returning guest Jerry Marzinski. He was awarded the State of Arizona's Meritorious Service Award and the Pima College Apple Award of Teaching Abnormal Psychology. He holds a BA in psychology from Temple University, a master's degree in counseling from the University of Georgia, and 2 years of study in a PhD psychology program. Jerry is the co-author of the book titled An Amazing Journey into the Psychotic Mind, Breaking the Spell of the Ivory Tower, and Jerry currently has a private practice in Arizona. We are also fortunately joined by author Judy Gregerson, who has recovered from a multi-voice schizophrenia and will share her story. With Judy's story, a familiar, clear picture forms in how these entities operate on people. Judy Gregerson is the author of 3 books, including Strategies for Overcomers and What I Learned in the Pit, and that's available this year, 2025. She's also studying the MACE energy method. Well, Jerry Marzinski and Judy Gregerson, welcome to Another News.
Well, thank you.
It's good to be here.
We'll start with Jerry. Jerry, you're one of several people leading the way in this rediscovery that the voices being heard by patients with specific psychotic conditions not only don't belong to the patient, but are actually a type of etheric predator. A predator generally invisible, yet can be physically heard and seen at times. A predator that is probably more likely an ancient parasite, very familiar with the vulnerabilities of the human host. This new approach to treating schizophrenia and similar psychosis opens up a range of topics, from the esoteric understanding of spiritual warfare to wrong-headed, misguided treatment by institutions influenced by and through pharmaceutical companies. Jerry, please give listeners an overview on this topic. And is there a trend forming where therapists and doctors are rejecting traditional treatment of schizophrenia and are instead using MACE energy method to heal patient trauma?
I think it's just beginning. It's just starting off. That not many people realize how effective MACE is in the treatment of psychological illnesses. It does have more trouble with schizophrenia, depending on how deeply it is set in. This whole story is strange as the strangest fiction that you've ever encountered. I mean, it is very strange. And I was in denial for probably 25 or 30 years that I didn't want to believe in demons. I didn't want to believe. I thought these voices were some kind of subconscious, something gone wrong in the brain. You know, I was brainwashed just like everybody else when I first started work at one of the biggest psychiatric hospitals on the planet. Almost 10,000 people there when I first started working there at Central State Hospital in Georgia. You know, there were every kind of mental illness there that you could imagine. But I was working for the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. So our job was to find the highest functioning patients in that hospital, train them in the job, and then get them out of there. Okay? And what I saw was that most of the highest functioning ones were paranoid schizophrenics. Right? And what I saw was that as they approached succeeding at their courses, they would do something to sabotage themselves. They would go off their meds. They would get into a fight. They'd do something to sabotage themselves, which was very strange. This also appeared to have a one-to-one correspondence with whatever the voices were. So I was like, what are these things? Because what we were taught in school, they were auditory hallucinations. And when you think of a hallucination, you think it's just all over the place. There is no rhyme or reason to it. It's just random. I mean, you can't predict a hallucination. I thought it was like word salad. But the more I spent with the psychiatric population and with schizophrenics, I saw that they were speaking to something that I couldn't see. And what they were talking with, it was a coherent conversation. It wasn't word salad. It wasn't something that just didn't make any sense. They were carrying on full-fledged, rational, somewhat, conversations with something. And you know, I would try to sneak up behind one, you know, periodically to see if I could hear what they were talking about. I watched one lady that she was arguing with her voices that she didn't want to leave the hospital grounds, and the voices were coercing her to do that. So here she is arguing with the voices saying she didn't want to leave as she's walking off the hospital grounds. So more and more I noticed that the patients were carrying on conversations with these things. And I'm like, well, that's strange. So I began asking staff, you know, what are they? What do you think they are? And all of them were brainwashed with this hallucination stuff. That's what they taught me in graduate school also. That's what they were teaching the psychiatrists and the doctors and the nurses, right? That this was, these voices were due to a chemical imbalance in the patient's brain. But other odd things started coming out that didn't agree with this. So what I was seeing with my own eyes didn't match what I was taught in graduate school. Now, one of these things was these voices are due to a biochemical imbalance of the brain. But I watched what psychiatrists did when they had these patients in their office. You would think, okay, if it's a chemical imbalance of the brain, they would have to have some kind of baseline. You know, what neurotransmitters in the brain are out of whack and by how much? None of that was happening. I watched time after time as they brought the patient in. They asked them what was going on. If they said they heard voices, they just picked one of the medicines that they use, and they said, okay, I'm starting you on this. There was no objective test to measure what neurotransmitters were out of balance or by how much. Right? So what is this chemical imbalance stuff? So I asked one of the psychiatrists, I said, where did this come from? If it's a chemical imbalance, how come you're not administering some kind of test to see which neurotransmitters are out of balance and by how much? And his response was, oh, the drug companies take care of that for us. We just administer the medications. And I'm like, well, what? You know, that's like letting the fox loose in the hen house. And this was the response I got. You know, what I later found out is not only is there no chemical imbalance in the brain of schizophrenics, there's no genetic schizophrenia germ either, you know, and that this biochemical imbalance thing was made up by a drug company named Eli Lilly back in the 70s or the 80s when they came out with Prozac. So it was not until the late 1980s, after the release of the landmark antidepressant Prozac, that the idea of chemical imbalance hits the psychiatric mainstream. Right? This was completely made up. It was fabricated. There was no research behind it whatsoever. They did it to sell drugs. So the psychiatrist Peter Briggen in 1991 points out in his book Toxic Psychiatry that the drug company Eli Lilly advanced the chemical imbalance theory as a marketing scheme to sell their new drug Prozac. There was no demonstrable evidence showing that depression or schizophrenia had any chemical imbalance, but Lilly ran with it. You know, before long, psychiatrists and psychiatric patients alike came to identify with the idea that mental disorders are caused by a chemical imbalance of the brain. It was a complete, abject lie. They passed it off on the entire planet. You know, you look at their DSM. This is a psychiatric Bible. It's the Directory of Psychiatric Illnesses. Okay? None of those have any way to validate the diagnosis, which is objective. These are all subjective mental illnesses made up by psychiatrists in this group that they have meet every few years, two-thirds of which are tied up with big pharma. So they just make up these mental disorders, and then they vote on them, and they go, well, can we make a medicine to make money off of this mental disorder? If they can, they put it in their Bible, in their DSM. In the PhD program, they treated this DSM, this Directory of Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses, as if it was a Bible. They taught it in classes. They had whole classes on it. It's completely made up. And they keep adding more to it all the time.
I don't think a lot of listeners understand how deep the influence is of these pharmaceutical companies within the universities and dominating.
Massive. It's massive.
The procedures to treat, you know, a range of mental illness based on, you know, the profit margins. And as I mentioned in the introduction, we are with Judy Gregerson. Judy, you were at the mercy of these voices that were destroying your life. Please take listeners through how it began, how old you were, what was the catalyst, and where were you living at the time?
Well, it started when I was very young. I grew up in a family with alcoholics and I was horribly traumatized. I was also sexually abused as a three-year-old, which I didn't even remember till I was 25 years old. By the time I was 12, I was binge drinking. I took a bottle of pills, tried to kill myself. When I was 16, I slipped my wrists. My mother left when I was 13. The family collapsed, and I went into a severe, severe depression in high school. And when I came out of that depression, I had a real lack of identity. I didn't really know who I was. I didn't know where I was going, but I did go off to college, and early in my freshman year, again, I tried to slip my wrists. I got involved in a lot of LSD. I did a tremendous amount of LSD my freshman year of college, and at one point I had a bad trip, and that bad trip scared me to death. It just scared me to death. And all during this time, this freshman year, and while doing the LSD, I could feel myself losing grip, you know, on not on reality, but on life. I felt detached. I felt lost. I felt like I didn't know what to do. I had a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And then I had, you know, a bad acid trip, and that kind of sent me over the edge. And I was never quite the same after that. I thought my mind had snapped. I was different. I was emotionally different. I was mostly scared and anxious. So I went home that summer from college, and I worked as a waitress, and I started having these episodes where I would black out, but I'd be walking, but I'd black out for seconds at a time, and the world would go quiet, and I couldn't see anything, and I didn't know what was going on, and then boom, I'd be back in reality. didn't know what was going on, but I felt like I was slipping away, and I had a tremendous amount of negative emotions in my life from my upbringing, from the betrayal of my parents. I mean, they so often threw me under the bus emotionally, so that they could be and they could do their alcoholism. So I finished out the summer and realized that I was in a bad place emotionally, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know where to go. So I went back to college, and when I got back there, there was a guy that I'd known freshman year, and I was crazy about him, and I really wanted to be with him. But I was very leechy, what my daughter would call like a stage four Klingon, and he couldn't deal with it at all. So he left college, and it snapped me, because to me he was the last thread that I had. I didn't know what else I had to live for.
How old were you at this time?
I was 19.
Trauma that you didn't even know was trauma when you were 3 years old. Alcoholic parents. I'm guessing they were alcoholics through your teens.
My mother's alcoholism began when I was 8. Well, it began before that. I recognized it when I was 8. So my sister and I would go and we'd find the bottles of vodka and rye hidden around the house and pour them out. And she would take us out at night to find my father, who was cheating on her. And she almost drove us into the bay one time because she was driving drunk. She'd wake us up in the middle of the night and drive us around drunk and terrorize us.
Is this in New York City? Where is this?
Long Island. I grew up in Long Island.
Oh, you grew up in Long Island. Okay. A lot of listeners in that area, just so we have a bearing. What part of Long Island would people recognize here?
I grew up on the North Shore on the very end in a little town called Southold by Greenport, which is now a kind of a destination town, which is almost to the end of the North Fork, directly across the bay from the Hamptons.
Oh, yeah. Way up there. Very, very nice, but very cold.
Very New England-y. I mean, my town was a little New England town with white picket fences. It'd been settled in 1640. My family members had settled it. They'd come over in the Mayflower and then went to Long Island, and so we had a long family history there, which I didn't know then. And then when I went to college up in Oswego,
by the Great Lake.
And I lived about 250 feet from the Great Lake, from Lake Ontario. So I was 19 at the time.
The trauma Judy is talking about is one of the triggers that sets off schizophrenia.
Correct, Jerry. So you had the trauma early at age 3, which we'll briefly go over, but I just wanted listeners to know where you were. Sometimes environment really puts a context on it for listeners. And then you have a family lineage that goes back to the pilgrims who came here. That might be significant as well. Then the LSD trip, Jerry Marzinski has pointed out in many, many interviews how drugs are a significant catalyst. But you also had this trauma early on in your life at 3, and then you had a bad trip. So what happened in this bad trip, if you can just kind of describe that for listeners? Where were you? What happened?
I was in a dorm room with some friends. We were tripping. And you remember that TV program back in the 70s called the FBI?
Vaguely. Jerry, do you know that show?
No, vaguely.
Okay.
Yeah. I was watching that show, and they were after somebody. And I also had been involved in high school, my last year of high school, with somebody in organized crime who had at one point tried to strangle me. So I had a little bit of paranoia about that, and also people he knew that I'd met through him would appear when I was in college and tell me to be careful who I spoke to and what I said. So I had that pressing on me, and I felt like they were after me. So I was watching this FBI show, and they were after somebody, and I went into complete terror that somebody was coming to get me and they were going to kill me. I really thought the mafia was going to come and kill me. And I was absolutely terrorized. And that may have been the LSD acting on this whole terror thing that I was going through. But after I came down from that trip, I never felt the same, and I never felt safe because I was convinced somebody was coming to get me, and they were going to kill me.
Judy, at what point did the voices start?
They started later. They started when I, after this guy left college, I decided that I was done. I had nothing to hold on to, so I took a bottle of pills. And I took this bottle of pills, and I thought very, very clearly, you know, if I don't call somebody, I'm going to die, and I'm going to go to hell. And you know, I didn't want to go to hell. So I called somebody, ended up in the hospital, pulling out tubes and hitting nurses, and then was channeled into the mental health system. So right around that time, right before I went to see the psychiatrist, I was smoking pot one day. And as I was smoking pot, I kind of was visualizing in my mind, and I saw this big door, this big, big wooden door. While I'd been doing LSD, I'd walked through a lot of portals, a lot of portals on LSD. I don't know what that was about, but there were. So I was used to going through portals. I thought, oh, it's a portal. And I was stoned out of my mind. I thought, well, I'll walk through this portal. So I opened this door in my mind, and I could see, I walked through, and I could see that the area behind the door was kind of this gray-white, not white-white, but kind of a gray-white, a dull, very dull white. And I couldn't see anything in there, almost like being in a fog, I guess I would say. And I walked through, and I shut the door, and then the voices started. And they started tormenting me and telling me that I was crazy and I had lost my mind and I was trapped and I was never getting out. My life was worth nothing. I was never going to be anybody, that it would be better if I would just die. And they would scream at me and scream at me. And not only did the voices come, but the voices had a presence. They had a presence you could feel. You could feel the, it was such a heavy oppression. And with it came so much fear and paranoia, because here I was locked, and I thought, what did I do? How did I do? What happened to me? Well, I knew up to that point that I thought up to that point that I was going crazy. All that summer and coming back to college that year, I thought I was going crazy, especially after that acid trip. But
this
now
negativity,
I was.
This negativity is one of the first patterns that you can notice. And it's with all schizophrenics. Those voices are consistently, unswervingly insulting, abusive, destructive, and derogatory. You know, what holds them to that pattern? How come they are not random? How come they're not sometimes good, sometimes mediocre? How come they're always consistently negative? And what holds them to that pattern? Psychiatrists and institutions don't ask these questions. They don't even study the voices. They just pass them off, and it's the, one of the main, it is the main most important symptom of paranoid schizophrenic, and they just blow it away. They just ignore it.
Well, and you know, a big part of it was this paranoia that someone was coming to get me, which had begun with that acid trip, that paranoia started. But that paranoia that somebody was coming to get me put me into this hyper-vigilant state, because if the phone rang, I'd jump. Somebody knocked on the door, I jumped, because I thought somebody was coming to get me, because the voices told me that I needed to be punished. And I didn't know what for. I mean, I'd done a lot of crazy stuff in high school. I'd done a lot of drugs. You know, I'd done some things you'd end up in juvie for today if you got caught. You know, but that was the fun of growing up in Long Island, where there was nothing to do but mischief.
And Judy, what did you think those voices were when they first started?
Well, I up to that point really thought that I was having a breakdown. My mother had had a breakdown. And so I thought I was having a breakdown. And so those voices convinced me that I was crazy. And I thought, okay, I did this acid, my mind shattered. So now I have this shattered mind. And these voices are parts of my shattered mind. But the thing I couldn't figure out, Jerry, was, how do I put the pieces back together? And the other thing is, when these voices are running their dialogue in your head, which they do constantly, sometimes they let up, and then sometimes they hit hard. And when they're running that dialogue, there's no rest, there's no peace, there's no joy, there's nothing but hell. It's a hell. It's a living hell. It's a horror.
And you could feel yourself being drained, right?
I was so exhausted all the time because you're battling. I was battling them because, and I've explained this to some other people, I was on a certain level of my craziness, but I could see that by the way they acted and by the, you know, those voices were acting, I could see that I could go crazier. I could see that I could completely go over the edge and never come back. I could see it. I knew it. And so I was fighting to stay at what I would call level one, which was, it's bad enough, but I don't want to get any crazier. I don't want to be the person walking down the street mumbling, you know, talking to the wind. I didn't do that kind of stuff because I was protecting to make myself look as normal as possible. But I was in another, my mind was in another dimension. I don't know how to explain that to anybody. But when my roommate came home that night or that afternoon after I'd had this experience, I said to her, I'm not here anymore, because she could see something was wrong. I said, I'm not here anymore. And she said, where are you? And I said, I don't know. I'm locked behind this door. I can't get out. And she didn't understand. She just looked at me with, you know, with horror in her face. So I was, you know, shuffled in. Of course, she called the university and they sent over a counselor, and I was quickly shuffled into the psychiatrist, and he diagnosed me and put me on meds, gave me three meds, two for psychosis and one for side effects, because the first, I don't know how long, week, 2 weeks, 3 days, I don't remember, I went nearly blind from the drugs. My vision was so blurry, I couldn't go anywhere, because I couldn't navigate the world with that kind of blurriness. And so, you know, you're fighting this battle all the time, and they're sucking the energy out of you, because the battle is not to snap further. It's to maintain as much of yourself as you can, but you never feel like yourself. You never feel, you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, it's a great morning, I feel good today, I'm going to go do something. There was never a day like that.
What did those drugs do for you?
Well, those drugs turned me into a squid. I mean, I was just mush. They tranquilized me so heavily that the fatigue was even worse. There was no energy to do anything. You just kind of dragged through the days.
Did they get rid of the voices?
The voices became more my thoughts. I began to think it was more just me thinking. They weren't as distinctive as they were.
Or separated.
Yeah, they weren't as individual, and now melded kind of into my thoughts. And so now it was me telling myself, you're ugly, you're fat, you're not good for anything, you need to die, there's no future for you. Nobody loves you. You know, there's nowhere to go. You're never going to escape. And of course, the psychiatrist tells you that basically that you're never going to escape this. This is a life sentence.
Your brain is broken and it's a life sentence, yeah.
Judy, I had mentioned this to Jerry in a previous interview. I was just waking up, and this is a couple of years ago, I was just waking up from a night's sleep, and I heard a voice whispering, chattering away. So I'm laying there, motionless in bed. My eyes are still closed. I'm trying to hear these words. Somebody whispering away, you're worthless, you're ugly, you're a failure, on and on and on. And my first reaction was just to laugh at how absurd this was and the desperation, but I mentioned this to Jerry, and he said, that's them. And I'm mentioning it to you because what you just said of these things that they're telling you, you're worthless, you're this, you're that. Have you caught any of this in the twilight of your sleep, things like that?
Well, you know, this happened 50 years ago, so it's hard to remember the details. But they spoke all the time, on and off. They were there, then they'd be sort of quiet, but the oppression was always there. You were never free. I was still always behind that door. You know, I was trying to figure out how to get out from behind that door. So,
and that door is metaphorical here, right?
Yep, it was a metaphorical door, but it was real to me. I was so stoned. And I think because I'd done so much acid where I was used to hallucinations, it was, in a sense, a hallucination, but it was real to me.
I experienced the same thing when I started really finding out what these things were. It was like I had one foot in that world and another foot in the world we're in right now. And I couldn't talk to anybody in this world about what was happening in that world except the schizophrenics. They were the only ones that understood it. You know, so I would carry on conversations with them about the voices and how they were behaving and what was happening that way. But I couldn't talk to anybody on this side. So, and it was like you said, it was like a door. It was like I had one foot on one side of it and another foot on the other side. Like a split between two worlds.
Yeah, and that living in two worlds. And you know, the voices would control me. They would use fear and anxiety to control me. They would tell me things like, if I went to the dining hall to eat, that a 747 was going to come flying through the building. That's how they keep me from eating. They would tell me, one time they told me if I ate this bun or roll or something, that my dorm was going to blow up. They once told me to kill one of my friends. They told me that this friend of mine, who was the one who got me into acid, they told me that he was the one that had broken my brain. It was his fault and he deserved to die. So he told me to pick up a lamp and crush his skull in. But I didn't, because I wasn't homicidal. I was suicidal. And I think Jerry will attest to this. I think most schizophrenics are either homicidal or suicidal. And that was the first thing the psychiatrist asked me. Do you want to kill anybody or yourself? And I was suicidal. I liked people. I didn't want to hurt anybody.
And you look at these mass shooters to kill a bunch of people. A lot of them have mental health problems, hearing voices that are telling them to shoot people, you know. And our mental health system is junk. All they do is pour chemicals on your brain. They don't cure anything. They don't know how. They don't know what causes schizophrenia, and they refuse to believe that it's these voices are spirits.
A lot of the shooters are on antidepressants.
Yes.
Or some kind of psychotropic. You don't really hear that consistent parallel that occurs again and again when the shooters are evaluated later.
Drug companies don't want that out there.
They don't, but that's very significant. Seems to amplify a condition that these entities, these voices, already laid the groundwork for. Judy, you're 19, you're post-LSD trip. I'm assuming you didn't take LSD after this had happened, correct?
After that bad trip, I swore off acid. I'd probably done 50 trips by then, and I decided no more. I still smoked pot. I drank a lot of alcohol. I drank alcohol to numb myself enough to survive, because living in this world, this world that you live in your head, is a void. It's a void that has nothing but bad in it, nothing but negative in it. There's nothing good in it, and it's a hell to live in.
That use of drugs is common. You know, the voices will tell patients, you know, go off these awful drugs where they're, you know, blurring your mind and you can't think, and you know, go get some cocaine or alcohol. At least you'll feel good with those drugs. You know, these drugs don't make you feel good. They're really not helping you a great deal. Go get some other drug. I mean, that's common. And virtually all schizophrenics will, at one time or another, go off those drugs. They don't like them. They're awful drugs.
Okay, so you're in that state where you're drinking alcohol, smoking weed, and taking the prescribed medication. What transitioned you out of this where you could function?
Well, I went through several years of what I call the doldrums, which is the drugged up death spiral that I was in. And over, sophomore year I went through it, junior year I went through it. And I got to a point where I was so exhausted, I was so tired of fighting, I was so tired of hearing the negative. And the thing is, when you're hearing this negative all the time, you begin to believe it. Okay? And when you begin to believe it, that begins to act on you as well.
One patient I asked, I said, if you know these things are liars, why do you believe it? And he says, because they're so damn believable. Mm-hmm. So they are very convincing. And Judy, did you ever try turning to religion during that time and prayer?
Well, I met a woman who preached the gospel to me one day in the student union, and told me that Jesus loved me, and that just ticked me off no end. I mean, I just wanted to hit her.
Well, that's the voices. They're anti-religious. They don't want to hear anything about prayer or Jesus or God.
Yeah. So I ran away from her, but I later called her. She'd give me a little tract. I later called her and I told her I do think Jesus is God, and I'm willing to accept him into my life, because I thought that it would cure me. So I became a Christian, and she was all excited about it. And I thought, well, this is my answer. God's going to help me. So I went to bed that night thinking I was going to wake up in the morning and I was going to be fine. But I woke up the next morning and I wasn't fine.
And how did the voices react to that? How did the voices react to you turning to religion?
Well, they mocked me for it, because they told me that Jesus was a weakling. He was a wimp. He'd allowed people to kill him. Why would I want to serve a God like that? Why would I love a God like that? Why would I give my life to a God like that?
So second question is why would a hallucination be anti-religious? Why would that happen? If it's a hallucination, why would it be anti-religious? They don't deal with that.
Yeah, they don't like Jesus. They don't like the Bible. They didn't like me reading the Bible. I got involved. It was during the Jesus movement. I got involved on campus with a lot of the Christian kids there. They were really nice people. They were kind to me. But the voices did everything they could to discourage me from going to church, from reading the Bible, from giving up drinking. But, you know, I was in no place where I was going to give up the drinking, because it was all I had to numb the numb.
You know, these are set patterns. These are patterns that all schizophrenics will run into. And there's 23 others that follow. You know, so these aren't hidden. They're right out for everybody to see. You can go to my website at jerrymarcinski.com, go to articles, and you'll see a whole list of these patterns that Judy's revealing one by one right now. They're right there in front of your eyes.
Let me jump in for a minute. Jerry, some people get out from these, you know, the doldrums that Judy is describing here, but others do not. And, you know, does it move into something more violent and maybe a possession? Does anything like that occur, or does it kind of stay in this sort of monotone, kind of gray reality of constant parasitism?
No, I've seen where they completely, it's rare, but they completely take over the person. Completely. There was one Arab guy that came into the emergency room one day when I was working site crisis. His father brought him in. Every time his father called him by his birth name, this guy would get furious. And he would say, I'm not your son. I'm not Joe Blow, whoever you know. My name is, you know, something else. And he would get furious, and he would actually attack the father for calling him his birth name. You know, and he wasn't the same person at all. And that thing wasn't going anywhere. It had a good tight hold on him. So I don't think that guy was ever going to be coming back. We did admit him. We admitted him into the psych hospital. And there were others, you know, where these things will completely take him over. It's rare, because usually the person understands that they're fighting against something. It's like Judy. They don't understand what's going on, but they don't want to go any deeper either.
Well, and the thing is, too, that you know, I mean, I knew that it could get so bad that my mind would be gone and I would not be there anymore. I knew that. I could see what they were pressing me for, because they'd press harder and harder. And that's part of the reasons I went into the doldrum. You go into this numbed state of just holding on and always looking for an answer. I spent hours trying to figure out how to fix my brain, hours trying to figure out how to put the pieces back together so that I could stop this. Because I could see that if I didn't stop it, I could see where I was going. One of two things would happen. Either my mind would finally totally be gone and I wouldn't be there anymore, or I would end up dead.
You know, Sherry Sweeney said something similar. She said the voices were trying to convince her to just let go, They told her you'd be taken care of in the mental hospital. You wouldn't have to worry about anything. You'd get meals every day. You'd get food. You'd get medicine. Just let go and let us take over and you'll be fine.
Yeah, but that letting go means letting them have your mind. And there was always that threat that it was going to totally take my mind and that I was going to completely self-destruct so that I wouldn't even exist anymore. I mean, that's how you picture it as a schizophrenic. You're just going to self-destruct.
Okay, we're getting into the nature of these, some of the strategies for these entities to keep feeding off of the patient. It doesn't necessarily make sense to kill the person, even though they want the person, it seems, to commit suicide, but that could just be a strategy to keep squeezing as much negative energy and anxiety out of the individual.
So you wonder why they would kill the source of their food.
Correct.
The negative energy. Well, what happens is they will drain that person and try to get them to kill themselves. Once that happens, then the whole family reacts. You know, you have all the friends, all the family, you know, maybe hundreds of them going, well, why didn't we see this? Or we could have done something to prevent this. Or why didn't we step in? And they start blaming themselves. So now they've moved from one person to a whole bunch of people. And all of them are generating that negative emotional energy. And the reason that they're always saying this negative garbage is because they want to bring down your frequency level. They want to create negative emotion. That's what they feed off of. So they will move toward people who are badly abused, you know, sexually, physically, emotionally. They can smell that like sharks smell blood in the ocean. And then they'll go there and they'll dump gasoline on the fire. And then they'll feed off of that. So these things are energetic parasites also.
I'm glad you brought that up, Jerry. There are a lot of missing pieces to the story of what the entities are. Missing pieces that give the skeptics and institutional dogma a foothold to dismiss the concept that the voices patients are hearing aren't external. Would you please talk about any advancement in learning about these parasites or entities? The description is still very vague of what they are.
That's why I put out that list of 23 patterns. That's the operational definition of these things. They get louder after sunset. They get louder when ignored. They foster self-destructive behavior. They foster isolation. They don't want the person to be in touch with anybody. They break up families. They break up friends. They tell girlfriends their boyfriends are cheating on them and the boyfriends or girls are cheating on them. They want the person to be isolated so they can just have the person to themselves. They demand the attention of the victim. They maneuver for increased control constantly. They gaslight. They lie. They manipulate perception. And it goes on and on through all the 23. That's the operational definition of these things. You know, that's what they are, is what they do. And again, it's all in my website at jerrymarcinski.com under articles. If you're somebody who's working with schizophrenics or you have a schizophrenic in your family, you can go see this. It's not a mythical biochemical imbalance that they hide up in the clouds or a genetic thing that is buried in science that you'll never see. These things are all observable. And if they're running patterns, they can't be hallucinations, as the establishment is trying to convince everybody. That's a lie.
Yeah, Jerry, thank you so much for emphasizing that and that there are specific patterns and strategies. Judy, have you detected back when this was happening to you that there were specific strategies occurring and patterns and you're like, wait a minute, these are entities. It's not me. Did you notice that?
All I knew was that everything they said, everything they told me to do was negative. And so I didn't recognize patterns, but I did. I would, at sunset, when the sun went down, I'd go into tremendous fear. They would really ramp up at sunset. I don't know what it was about the sun going down. Maybe it was the darkness that was coming, and my mind was in so much darkness to begin with, that to see the whole world go dark was horrifying to me.
That's another pattern. And they get loudest between 3 and 4 in the morning consistently.
Well, you know, I heard from someone who studies ley lines that there is a shift in the telluric current across the Earth. The telluric current in the ley lines shift from going from north to south, south to north. Do you have that occurring? And maybe that's related. I know it's kind of out there, but it certainly makes me think about these types of events and the significance of inherent fear that was going on at sunset. And then people can't wait till the sun rises, where another shift in the telluric current happens. Judy, what was the catalyst? Were you eventually transitioned out of being in this gray normalcy of constant attacks, being the host to these parasites?
Well, you know, I got to a point where I realized I had to find an answer or I had to die. I mean, it came down to that. And I had searched and searched for an answer, and I decided I had to die. So I tried one day after I flunked out of college. I was living in my sorority house, and I tried to gas myself in the car, my car. And a friend of mine came and saved me and was screaming at me about wanting to die. And I said, yeah, I do want to die, because I figured that was my choice. I find an answer or I die. And when she saved me, I realized, okay, I'm going to have to find a new place to die. And I'd flunked out of school, so I moved to Syracuse. And there I went to a psychiatric hospital there and asked to be admitted. They wouldn't admit me for what it was, a residential center. They wouldn't admit me. They agreed to see me 3 times a week. And they set me up with this counselor who began to counsel me 3 times a week. And this is when things began to change, because he saw the trauma in me. I didn't see it. I didn't even know how traumatized I was. And he began to work on that. And I saw him 3 times a week. And we would visit all these emotions that I'd buried. I had fear and anger and resentment and bitterness from all this trauma of my childhood. And I'd also been molested by 2 older men when I was in my young teen years, and which was pretty common at that time, though, for most women I know. And so he began to get me to face my trauma, which was horrifying, because he was asking me to open up and let out all these feelings. And I didn't even know what I felt. I didn't know what anger felt like. I didn't know what resentment felt. I couldn't identify him. All I knew was that I felt bad. I had this big ball of feeling bad. But he began to draw it out of me, and I spent probably 6 months going to see him 3 times a week, crying and crying and crying. And we wiped off that top layer of trauma and that top layer of all that negative garbage from my life. And when that happened, the voices began to be less powerful. They began to come less often. They got weaker, and I began to feel like myself again at times. They still attacked. I still had my attacks where, you know, I'd be in a state of horror, but I had times where I was feeling pretty good. I began to make relationships. I hadn't made relationships in a couple of years, because they isolate you from everybody. And even if you have friends, you don't think your friends really like you anyway, and you think they're working against you somehow, and you think that they, you know, I always thought they all thought I was crazy. But I began to make relationships again, and I began to feel kind of sort of normal at times. And I thought, okay, I'm on the road to something. And he told me at the time, he was a Catholic guy. He was only, I don't even think he had a master's. I think he just had a, you know, bachelor's degree. And he was a good Catholic kid. And he told me that all this stuff that I had was sin. It's all sin. It's got to go. It's sin. And I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't care what it is. Let's go. And there was a tremendous release in letting that stuff go. But those voices still worked on me. They still worked on me at times. They still had power over me. I wasn't fully free. I was almost kind of sort of halfway there. So I was living in Syracuse, and I used to go to this charismatic Methodist church. And I went one Sunday, and there was this preacher from Philadelphia, and she was talking. And I had a sense that I needed to talk to her. I just felt compelled to talk to her. So I talked to her after church, and I told her my story. And I don't remember what she preached on that day, but it must have been something about spiritual warfare or something. And I started telling her my story, and she listened for a little while, and then told her the whole story about the boys, whatever. And she just stopped me dead, and she said, "Judy," you know, she asked me, "Are you a Christian? Do you believe in Christ?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "The voices that you're hearing are demons." And she said, "They have no power. They have no authority over you. You belong to Christ. He conquered them when he rose from the grave. They have no power over you," she said, "but you're going to have to fight them." And she gave me a little book with a bunch of scriptures in it, kind of divided by topics, you know, fear, anxiety. Do you have fear? Do you have anxiety? Whatever. And she said, "What I want you to do is when these things attack, whatever they attack you with, if it's fear, anxiety, find Bible scriptures in this little book and read it out loud to them. Read it, just read it out a couple of times. And then you tell them, 'In the name of Jesus Christ, get out of my life. You have no power, no authority over me, and I'm not going to tolerate you. Be gone.'" And I just looked at her like she was nuts. Because it's like, come on, it can't be that simple. And, I mean, I'd read in the Bible about Jesus casting out demons, but it was like, demons? And that also kind of scared me to death. It's like I'm dealing with demons? I mean, that's a horrifying thing, you know, for a 21-year-old. You've got demons. You've got four demons. Like, holy crap. So I took the book, and I didn't use it yet, but around the same time, my counselor told me I needed to get off the drugs. And that was horrifying to me because I thought, well, maybe if I get off, maybe I'm feeling better because the drugs are working now. And if I get off them, I'm going to lose everything I've gained. And so I wrestled with both getting off the drugs and doing this thing with my Bible verses. But I had improved so much that I thought, I'm going to go for it. I've gotten this far. Maybe this is God leading me. You know, I don't know. But maybe I ought to continue on this path. So I decided I'm going for it. So I was working at the time at a newspaper at Syracuse. And I was working on the copy desk typing computer code because it was rote. It was something I could do without thinking. And these presents, you know, come over me and the voices come and they start, you know, "You're a piece of crap, you should die." And then the fear would start up. So I grabbed this little book and I ran to the ladies' room and I opened up this book. I went in a little booth, made sure there was nobody there, and I started reading scripture out loud. And I read this scripture, "God's not given us a spirit of fear, but of love, power, and a sound mind." And I said, I have a sound mind. I have a sound mind. God gave me a sound mind. Because I didn't believe I had a sound mind, but kept reading it, and I said, I belong to Jesus. Get out of here. You can't touch me. You don't own me. You know, I don't belong to you. I belong to Jesus. Go in the name of Jesus." And they left. They left. And the oppression left, and the voices left, and the heaviness left, and everything that had to do with the state of mind I'd been in left instantly. And I was dumbfounded. Dumbfounded. I thought, wow, this is it. But they came back to test me, because they weren't going to give up easily. So then I'd be feeling pretty good, and then all of a sudden, boom, the attack would hit. So most of the time it was when I was at work, so I'd run into the bathroom with my little book, and I would read the scripture to them, and the more victory I got, and the more I realized that they would go almost instantly when I told them to go in the name of Jesus, I got bolder. And then I got pissed off, because I realized they were playing me, and they'd been playing me, you know, for almost 4 years. And I realized I wasn't going to let them win this game. I got emboldened. And I kept doing it. And finally, they went. So then I had to get off these drugs because I was still kind of numb. And, you know, I was dragged down by these things. And I decided to get off the drugs. So I took some time. I don't know how many days it was. 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. But by myself, I went through withdrawal. You know, I went through the shakes and the sweats and the fear and the, you know, crawling up into a fetal position and crying and carrying on for, you know, a couple of days. And then I woke up. It was April 14th, 1974. I woke up and I sat up in bed, put my feet on the ground, and I realized the drugs were out of my system. The demons were gone, and I was back. I was back. I was who I was when I went to college.
Wow, it's interesting you remember the exact date.
It was Easter morning. That was the strangest thing. It was a resurrection morning, and so on resurrection morning, my life was resurrected. It was crazy. It blew my mind.
That's going to do it for the first part of this interview with Jerry Marzynski and Judy Gregerson, both of whom are getting the word out to the public, normalizing the spiritual warfare associated with mental illness, while promoting the MACE energy treatment. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
Oh.